This is the recording. And so it is now Monday, May what, 4th? And Monday, May 4th, and we're doing elimination reactions today. So we finished our SN1 and SN2, which doesn't really seem like we finished them, and because we haven't really. What we did is we went over those reaction mechanisms and we looked at some examples of SN1 and SN2. And we showed how they compete a little bit. We finished up with the SN1 reactions, and we looked at kinetic versus thermodynamic control for some of those allylic cations that were created in those substitution reactions. And now we pick it up and we look at elimination reactions, and we're going to look at E1 and E2. So very similar to the substitutions, where we had first order and second order in the substitution reactions, we have first order and second order in the elimination reactions. And these make up the basic core of the first reactions that we really study. You know, everything up to this date has been studying reactivity and structure and how what governs stability, the various factors of sterics, resonance, induction, all of those different factors that govern stability. And then putting it into play in terms of looking at these reactions. And the SN1, SN2, E1, E2 form the first set of reactions that we study, that most organic chemistry classes study. And they are typically some of the most difficult material that we study. As we go forward, what we find is that the material does get more difficult as we keep going on, but that the SN1, SN2, E1, E2 form a particularly difficult set because there's a number of different concepts that play into these four different reactions. And that what we are going to eventually be doing is looking at how these four reactions compete and trying to decide which direction a reaction is going to go. Is it going to go SN1 or SN2 or E1 or E2? And within all of those different properties that govern which way a reaction goes, there is no set hierarchy such that while we can put priority on substrate, and then the second sort of level of priority is on the leaving group and the nucleophile, and then the third is sort of on solvent, and then the fourth is on temperature. While we can put those different hierarchies on things, the hierarchy changes based on certain things that go into the chemical reaction. So there's no set hierarchy, which is a difficult concept for most students. We would just want a list. Tell me which is the most important. I'll find that most important thing. I'll decide which way the reaction goes. And it doesn't quite work that way. So we're going to go through elimination reactions. And then we come back together in the next chapter after the elimination reactions. And we look at them again in more detail, putting more data to it to try to understand how important the different aspects are of these chemical reactions. So that's kind of where we sit in the big picture sort of scheme of things. So right now, as we start the elimination reactions, we're going to start them much in the same way that we started the substitution, by looking at some different reactions and then pulling it together, looking at a mechanism and then some examples under those mechanisms. So when we look at elimination reactions, the first thing to realize is that we're oftentimes looking at hydroxyl groups, but it doesn't have to be. It can be just a leaving group in general. And so this is an example of an elimination reaction that is under acid conditions, so acid catalyzed, that gives us the alkene plus the water. And this is a form of dehydration. So this is a dehydration reaction. And these dehydration reactions are both regio and stereoselective. So stereoselective, when we say stereoselective, what we mean is that cis versus trans. And that it's going to select for one of the other. So it's not going to give both. It's going to give us one or the other. And regioselective, you can think of regioselective as the region in which the double bond forms, so that if we have the possibility of having a hydroxyl group in a particular position, and we call this one and we call this two, that as it undergoes the elimination, it could go in a specific direction, and that we're going to find that the reactions are selective for one or the other, not both. And so they are both regioselective and stereoselective. So let's look at regioselectivity and show how regioselectivity actually works, or not how it works, but what it means in more detail. So regioselective. And as always, if you have questions, don't forget to stop me, slow me down, and get those questions answered. So if we take a hydroxyl group, which is a tertiary hydroxyl, or tertiary alcohol, let's say it that way, and we react this with H2SO4 at 80 degrees Celsius, we get two main products that come out of this. We get that guy and this guy. So numbering out the carbons, maybe this sometimes helps. Let's do this carbon number 1, 2, 3, and 4. And this guy out here, let's say that that is 5 connected in that way. What we have is 1, 2, 3, and 4, and that's 5. So we made a bond between 1 and 2. And in this one, we are 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So the bond is either made between 1 and 2 or between 2 and 3. And in terms of percentages, what we find is that it's 10% between 1 and 2 and about 90% between 3 and 5, where the double bond is made. So the regioselectivity is selecting for the more substituted double bond. Remember, we talked about the substituted nature of double bonds, and we said that the double bonds, in terms of their stability, followed a pattern where the more substituted the double bond was, the more stable it was. And so this is, actually I put the arrow going the wrong direction. Let's go this way, increasing stability. And that we had unsubstituted, monosubstituted, these were disubstituted, tri, and then tetra. And so what we're seeing is that here the disubstituted is only 10%, whereas the trisubstituted is 90%. So thereby the regioselectivity that we're seeing. Another example of that regioselectivity, if we start with a six-membered ring system and a cyclohexanol with a 2-methyl group, and we react this with phosphoric acid, H3PO4, and heat, so we'll take it up to refluxing temperatures, we find that we get two different products that come out of this. So the double bond can go to one of either areas here. So if we look at the two bonds, that bond versus that bond there, that we're finding that the tri-substituted essentially is 84%, and we get another 16% that goes to the disubstituted. So we're finding that these bonds tend towards the more substituted in terms of regioselectivity. And that is called Zaitsev's rule. And again, I tend to not focus on rules as much as I focus on the underlying mechanism. So we're gonna look at the underlying mechanism of where Zaitsev's rule comes from, but try not to think of it in terms of Zaitsev's rule, try to think of it in terms of the underlying mechanism. So don't memorize the rule, memorize the mechanism and what's happening here. So this is, though, Zaitsev's rule. It stems from 1875. And Alexander Zaitsev. And what Zaitsev noticed was that that in an elimination reaction, the tendency is always towards the more substituted product. But we need to understand that not in the context of the more substituted product. We need to understand that in terms of mechanistically what's actually happening here. So these are E1 reactions, elimination first order. And when we look at the mechanism of what's happening with this reaction, let's start off with a tertiary alcohol. So we'll start off with tertiary butanol. And these are all acid catalysts. So we'll have an acid that is present. We take the proton and we protonate the alcohol. Once the alcohol is protonated, it becomes a good leaving group. So our first step is in the creation of a good leaving group. Then the leaving group leaves, leaving behind a carbocation. Once the carbocation is formed, presumably some base in solution, the water that just left is an excellent base, takes the proton, which dumps in the electrons to form the double bond. And so we get the alkene, plus we get an equivalent of acid, hydronium in this case. So that's the reaction mechanism for alcohols. And basically what we're looking at there is in an energy diagram, we have the starting alcohol together with the strong acid. So the acids were, we'll just do it as HX. And then we go down to a more stable product, which is the protonated hydroxyl group, where we've got X now minus that is sitting out here. We then go to the carbocation intermediate, where the leaving group has been kicked off. So our water molecule is now sitting out here. And then we go to a double bond, which is the product, together with the hydronium that we created. Okay, so we have a small activation energy here. We have our rate determining step. So this is the activation energy for the rate determining step, which is the carbocation formation, and then a small activation energy that actually takes us towards the product. So this is our reaction coordinate and our energy on the y-axis. The rate of this chemical reaction, if we do it this way, the rate is equal to K times the concentration of, let's not say the protonated hydroxyl group, but let's just say the leaving group, because we're going to see that these are not always alcohols, and that this rate is essentially identical to an SN1 rate. They have the exact same rate. An E1 and an SN1 have the exact same chemical rate, which means that anytime you have an SN1, you also have an E1, that these two reactions, because they have the exact same rate, compete with each other. And so anytime you have an SN1, you also have an E1. Anytime you have an E1, you also have a competing SN1. So the same factors apply as in the SN1 reactions. Same factors apply as for SN1. that is namely that the rate is that a tertiary is faster than a secondary, is faster than a primary for the substrate that we're talking about, the R leaving group, and what that substrate actually looks like. And it's also important here that acid-wise, that when we use an acid for these, for the alcohols, that HI as an acid goes faster than HBr, goes faster than HCl, which goes a lot faster than HF. And the reason that you can think of it that way in terms of the acid catalyst is that it's just the strength of the acid, that we've got stronger acids. And if you think about stronger acid and our rate, if our rate is equal to K times the concentration of our leaving group, and our leaving group is the protonated alcohol, then for a stronger acid, you are going to have a higher concentration of the protonated alcohol. And therefore, the rate of the reaction is going to increase as the concentration of the protonated alcohol increases. They are directly correlated there. So that's where that comes from. Okay, in terms of regioselectivity, what we see in terms of regioselectivity is that if we take the first substrate that we looked at, so this was our tertiary alcohol, and we look at where the selectivity is coming from this, we protonate it. After we protonate it, then we've got loss of leaving group. And we generate the carbocation. And then once we get to the carbocation, now we've got some options. So here's our carbocation. And I know I've turned things around a little bit. Maybe it's better if I don't. Maybe it's better if we just keep everything looking exactly the way it was. But to me, this carbocation looks tetrahedral. And so I get a little bit concerned when I look at a tetrahedral sort of carbocation like that. So let's flatten it out. And let's say that these two things are the same. I think you can visually see how those two things can be the same at this point. And from here, we have two different protons that we can look at pulling. We have a proton which we can call HA, and we have a proton that we can call HB. So let's maybe color these guys different. So there's HA and HB. And there are six different HAs. So I think I should acknowledge that as well, that while we're looking at this, there are also HAs, two more on that carbon, and three more down here, all that would give the same product if I pulled them. So there are six HAs. And for HB, there are only two. So that's going to play into this a little bit as well. And we're not going to focus on that as much, but I thought that we should highlight that out. So what happens here is that the base, depending upon what the base pulls, if the base pulls HA or if the base pulls HB, I get different formations of different products. So minus HA leads to a product where I get the less substituted, and minus HB leads to a product where I get the more substituted double bond. Okay, everybody following along so far? And this is less substituted. And when we're saying substituted, we're looking at basically, let's pick a color that I can sort of highlight the substituted nature of the bond. So this is disubstituted. This one is trisubstituted. Okay, so energy-wise, what's happening here is that when I go to pull these two protons, the difference between the two protons, now let's retry it. The difference between the two protons and what I'm looking at pulling is HA is primary and HB is secondary. And in order to pull the primary proton, as a base comes towards the primary proton, it's fairly easy and accessible because of that primary nature. So we can say that for the primary, there are less sterics to access the primary proton. And this one that is secondary, as the base comes in to pull the secondary one, it gets more sterics around it because of the different alkyl groups that are there. So to access the secondary proton, there are more sterics. And that makes the activation energy for pulling the second proton higher, whereas the activation energy for pulling the primary is lower. However, the products that they lead to, when I look at the thermodynamic nature of the products, the more substituted is more stable, and the less substituted, less stable. So when I think about an energy diagram for these, if we start out from a common location, where we have the carbocation, and we look at progression in two different directions. We can look at the progression for forming the less stable product, in this case, that double bond, and forming the more stable product. So I'm running a energy diagram in two directions, and we talked about this once before too, where I've done this once before, so this is not a linear progression. I'm looking at time zero and a reaction coordinate, which is going off in both directions. So I'm sort of doing my reaction coordinate forwards in time in both directions so that I could look at both of them simultaneously in a slightly easier way. And what I find is that to pull the primary proton, it's a lower activation energy. And to pull the secondary proton, it's a higher activation energy. And so that my energy diagram looks like this. So this is my transition state for pulling secondary proton that has high sterics. And my transition state for pulling the primary proton with less sterics. And what that sets up is a difference in activation energies and a difference in stability of products that we've seen before. And that is a kinetic versus thermodynamic situation. So that what I have is I have the product here that is easy to form, forms fast, and at low temperatures. This is what we call a kinetic product. And the other one over here is harder to form, requires more energy. So we have higher temp plus longer reaction time. And this is the thermodynamic product. And so this sets up the kinetic versus thermodynamic situation that we've seen before. when we were looking at the SN1s and SN2s, they came from the SN1 reactions. But here we're seeing it directly with the E1 eliminations, that when we have the carbocation and we're seeing selectivity, that we're generally seeing selectivity for the more substituted double bond. Although if we change the reaction conditions, we can try to get some selectivity towards the less substituted. So for instance, if I take this reaction now, same reaction, and we look at doing this reaction under a couple of different conditions. So we will do it at H2SO4 for 1 hour, but we'll look at it by changing the temp, and we'll look at running it at 80 degrees C and at 30 degrees C. Still for 1 hour, just running it at two different temperatures. And we know that we get the two products that come out of this. So let's draw our two products. And the percentages that we see is at 80 degrees C, we see about 10% of the disubstituted and 90% of the trisubstituted. At 30 degrees C, it becomes 60 and 40. And you can see that it's very difficult to push it towards getting 100% of the disubstituted, but at the lower temperatures allow me to select for the less substituted, whereas the higher temperatures are pushing it towards the thermodynamic product. And so that's the important part that we're seeing there, is that this is the kinetic and the thermodynamic. And kinetic is selected by low temp and short reaction times. And I know we didn't vary the time, but we need to keep one variable constant while we change the other one. And the thermodynamic is selected by high temp and longer reaction times. So there's an example of our kinetic versus thermodynamic in action and how the temperature change changes which product becomes the major product. How are you guys doing? Yeah.
Why don't you get as much of the kinetic product at 30 than you did of the thermodynamic in the 80?
Okay, I love that question. And it has to do with the different activation energies and what is actually happening in the chemical reaction. So if we take a look at a Boltzmann distribution of energies associated with the activation energies. So in a Boltzmann distribution, remember that what we have is this curve for whatever temperature we're at. And let's say that this is the 80 degree curve. So this is at 80 degrees C because that's the average in terms of temperature. And so this is our hot curve. So let's take this curve and let's say this is red, style red. So this is our hot temperatures. And the activation energies for our two, we're just gonna have to make up some activation energies. So let's call this product A and B, and that the activation energy for B is higher than the activation energy for A. So here is the activation energy for product B, and maybe the activation energy for product A. And then when we change temperatures and we go to a lower temperature, let's say 30 degrees, our 30 degree sort of temperature has this sort of Boltzmann distribution. Although that's not looking as pretty as I want to make it. Let's try it again. It doesn't seem to want to go down to the bottom. I'm working too close to the bottom of my screen. That'll help. Okay, and so this one is blue. Ooh, except I did it in two parts, didn't I? Style blue. Okay, and this is my 30 degrees. And I guess this activation energy, we can say, even creeps into part of this over here. So that when I look at the number of products that can be formed from this, I'm trying to be consistent in coloring scheme. Let's say that the activation energy for the product A that can be formed, what color do I want to do it in? Let's just do it in black, I guess. Is that all of these products here, everything that has this amount of energy can form product A, but only these guys out here can form B. Oh, Finley. And then when we get down to this lower part, I guess I'll have to color it in blue. And then these guys here are the only ones that can form B in this one. That from looking at the energy of what can make it over the activation energy barrier only tells part of the story. It doesn't tell the entire story. That when we look at the percentages and the way that I've drawn it out and which molecules can make it over the activation energy at the different temperatures is only part of it. The other part of it is when we go up to this energy diagram, that initially what winds up happening is at low temperatures, the product that is first made is A. And then what winds up happening is this product is somewhat reversible and can go back to the intermediate carbocation through an addition reaction. But every time a product goes over and forms this guy, which is B, it cannot go back because it is prohibitively too high in activation energy to go backwards. And so what happens is B accumulates, whereas A is reversible. And when we're looking at these temperatures, and I'm giving these different temperatures, presumably at 80 degrees, there's enough activation energy to get over the hump, but not to go backwards. And therefore, A winds up accumulating in a large degree, in a large amount. So A here is accumulating. B, on the other hand, while it forms fast, it's reversible. And given that reversible nature, even at 30 degrees C, there's still enough energy in there to get over the activation energy for B. So I'm looking at just this little bit here. And the few that do get over there wind up accumulating and don't go back. So the percentages don't absolutely reverse. It's just that I can get this one to become major, but not where I get it exclusively or get it in 90%. Because if there's enough activation energy to be able to get over the first activation energy barrier, there's still enough to be able to get over the second barrier to some degree, and that accumulates, and that accumulation always makes this component of B fairly high. And I'm just always going to get that. It's very difficult to try to get this into like a 90% yield and get just 10% of this guy over here because of the way that it accumulates, even at lower temperatures. Even at those lower temperatures, the activation energies are not that different such that I can prohibit getting any of this product B. And once I get enough energy to get some B, the B accumulates and becomes a fairly high yielding component. Does that help to some degree, Roxana?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, cool. That was a good question. All right. Let me take and let's do a couple more examples now with some different substrates and look at some possibilities. So let's look at this possibility where we've got an alcohol. And these are not all alcohols, by the way. I know that I'm focusing on alcohols to begin with because that's the way that your textbook does it. but that Klein decided to do it. But E1s and E2s can be all different types of leaving groups. So we start with alcohols and then we'll branch it out into different leaving groups. Let's do this with phosphoric acid, H3PO4. And let's do heat. And so we should be able to get a couple of different products that come out of this. So one product that should be possible should be the double bond on that side. And then let's do the mechanism really quick. And let's look at the mechanism. So the mechanism is going to be that I'm going to have a proton. I'm going to pick up that proton, protonating the oxygen. Once I protonate the oxygen, I create a good leaving group. The leaving group presumably leaves, leaving me behind the carbocation. And then once I get the carbocation, I look at where there are protons that I can pull. So a base can pull the proton, dumping the electrons in, and that's where that product comes from. Now, are there any other protons that I can pull? Or maybe that's the only proton, because there are alkyl groups at all the other positions. So if I'm looking at where I have protons, I have these protons that I can call HA, and there are three of them. And there is a proton which sits underneath the carbocation here. We can call that HB, but you can't pull HB because it's on the carbocation, so that won't lead to a double bond if I pull that proton, so that doesn't take me anywhere. And then I have protons that are out here, which we could call HC, but they are not beta to the carbocation. They're gamma in a way. They're offset from the carbocation that they can't dump directly into the carbocation if I pull them. So it looks like I only get one product out of this. However, this is only 3% of the chemical reaction. I also get two other products that come out of this. The two other products look like this and this, and they are in yields that are 64% and 33%. And so the question is, well, where did these guys come from? If there were no other protons to pull, how did I get those other two reactions, or how did I get those other two products that came out of that?
Is that from the alkyl transfer that happens first?
Yes, it's from the carbocation rearrangement. So we look at the carbocation rearrangement that not only can I pull the proton, but I can also go this direction and I can get a 1-2 methyl shift, what we've been calling an alkyl shift. So we can get the 1-2 methyl shift, and that leads me to now a carbocation that looks like this. So we went from what was a secondary to now what is a tertiary carbocation. And from the tertiary carbocation, now there is a proton here that was HB, that is the same HB. So we can even color code these. HB was sitting here. And HC is now sitting out here. And now I can get the loss of HB, which takes me to the tetrasubstituted, or I can get the loss of HC, which takes me to the disubstituted. And by being more stable, by being more substituted, this is my thermodynamic product. Versus my kinetic. And there are actually multiple kinetic products. This is also a kinetic product. So I'm favoring towards my thermodynamic. And how do I know that I'm favoring my thermodynamic product? It's the high heat. That when we see that symbol, we're recalling that that symbol is telling us that we're under reflux conditions, which equals high heat. and that's going to equal a thermodynamic product.
Hey, Jason, I have a question.
Go for it.
Is it possible for heating under reflux to not be enough to achieve the thermodynamic product as the major product?
I don't think so. I think that under most solvent conditions, I mean, it really depends on the solvent. So if you have a solvent like maybe diethyl ether that is going to boil at 32 degrees Celsius, that maybe you're not going to get enough energy in order to get to the thermodynamic product. However, most of those solvents that are that low of boiling are also non-ionizing, such that we generally aren't working within those lower boiling solvents. I guess it's feasible, but not generally the case. I would say that if you see the triangle, if you see the capital delta symbol, that that is really meaning high heat, and that you should always select for the thermodynamic product in that case. It would be a rare exception, and it would have to be told to you that it was an exception for you to go the other direction. Okay? Let's look at another example. Let's take a primary alcohol this time and react it with H3PO4, phosphoric acid, under reflux, and we get a couple of products. We get that guy, plus that guy, plus this guy. So we get the kinetic, which is presumably coming from the primary carbocation after loss of leaving group. And so we're pulling the proton. We can call this proton HA. And so by a base coming in and pulling that proton, that's going towards the kinetic. From that primary carbocation, we can then get the hydride shift of HA leading towards the secondary carbocation. And now we can have the loss of the protons out here that we can call HB. And they can give us two different products. So loss of HB can go either towards the cis or towards the trans. And what we know is that when we looked at energy because of the sterics here that's in the cis, that that's a higher energy product, and that these guys are 32%, 56% for the trans, and for the kinetic, 12% for the kinetic. And overall, when we're looking at cis versus trans, we're getting 88% together that are the cis and trans products. Okay? So, and that hydride shift really is fast and giving us the majority of the product that's coming out of that. Okay, what else do we need to do here? We've done the methyl shift. Let's look at dehydrohalogenation. Sorry, I should have asked if there's any questions. Nobody's throwing anything in the chat. You guys are really quiet, so I'm guessing that this is looking okay then. In a dehydrohalogenation, what we're doing here is very similar sort of reaction, only our leaving groups are halogens. So we have a halogen, we react this with a base, something like sodium ethoxide, NaOET, in ethanol. We'll do the reaction at 55 degrees C. And what we get is a single product that comes out in 100% yield. And we get ethanol and sodium chloride. And basically what's happening here is that the chloride and the hydrogen, the ethoxide ion is pulling the hydrogen, dumping electrons in, and kicking out the chloride to produce the double bond. So that's where that comes from. And this concept of using, I'll get to that concept later. Let's go and let's look at the next reaction. Let's look at a couple of reactions here, and then we'll talk about some things. Let's look at, so this was a secondary alkyl halide. This one will be a primary alkyl halide. We're going to react this one with a reagent that is called potassium tert-butoxide. And the potassium tert-butoxide reaction is done in tertiary butanol. We'll do this one at 25 degrees Celsius. And we get the corresponding double bond in about 86% yield. What's the remaining 14%? We're not going to talk about at the moment, but we're going to leave that sort of open. Just looking at the various reactions that, we can get here. Let's take and do one more. Actually, I got two more. Let's do a chloride. This one now is tertiary. We'll use potassium ethoxide rather than sodium ethoxide, also in ethanol. This one at a higher temperature, 70 degrees C, and we find that we get products that were identical to what we did in one of the first reactions that we looked at, and in pretty similar yields, 29% and 71%. So we're seeing there kinetic versus thermodynamic selectivity in favoring the more substituted. Again, we're at a slightly higher elevated temperature. I know it doesn't say the triangle, it doesn't say refluxing, but we're going to talk about what is a high temperature and what is a low temperature and try to get a handle on that. And then one more example. Let's do a bromide that is a secondary bromide symmetrical. This one reacting with potassium ethoxide as well in ethanol. I don't have a temperature on this one, but what we see is that this gives 77% for the E product and 20, I'm gonna have to number my bonds and make sure I got this right, 23% for the Z double bond. So Z being same side, cis, E being engaging opposite, that's the trans. So we're thinking about that in terms of E versus Z because cis and trans isn't always going to do it for us. And why are we not getting SN2 products in this reaction, Eric? Because we're trying to focus on the eliminations right now. And in the next chapter, we're going to bring that together and look at how much of SN2 and eliminations we get at the same time. But right now, if I put SN2 into it or E2 into it, we're going to complicate the picture, and I don't want to complicate it just yet. So I want to focus on just the elimination reactions, and then we'll bring those other things into it in the next chapter. Okay. Let me go through and number my carbons really quick. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 5, 6. There's 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Okay. Now we're better. I just want to make sure. Even sometimes when I'm doing it, I got to sit there and make sure that I draw out and number everything so that I see where everything is going. So we're seeing some different reactivities here and differences in the way that primaries react versus tertiaries versus secondaries. And we kind of need to pull this all together and see what's going on in here. So let's talk about the next reaction because they're not all E1s. Some of these are E2s. And so we need to talk about E2 reactions. E2 elimination, second order. And these E2 reactions have a reaction mechanism that is second order in rate. So what we typically have is we typically have a leaving group and a proton, And then I'm going to leave this as stereocenters, or draw them sort of as stereocenters. And we can have different groups that are in those places. Let's just call them R prime. Then we could do R double prime and R triple prime. So these can be the same group, or they can all be different groups. We have a base, generally, that is negatively charged. The base pulls the proton, dumping the electrons in and pushing out the leaving group, such that this is all concerted. And in being all concerted, the bond making and bond breaking is all happening simultaneously, so that we get a transition state that is moving towards becoming flat. And the base is connected here. And so what I have is I have a partial negative on the base, and I have a partial negative on the outgoing leaving group. And that is my transition state. And the transition state breaks down to form the alkene. That was that one. Plus, I get the base now pulling the proton. And that if I take and look down this bond, like a Newman projection, not like a Newman projection, but look down it as a Newman projection, what I find is that that Newman projection shows me the proton and my different R groups. And my leaving group. So here is my leaving group. And my different, this is R prime. I think that's the third prime, that's the second one. And that the base is pulling this proton, kicking electrons in and kicking out the leaving group. And one of the really important things here is that the leaving group and the proton are anti to one another. That the proton and leaving group are anti to one another, and that they must be anti to one another in order for this reaction to go forward. That is a restriction in the chemical reaction that has to happen, and we'll talk about why that has to happen. And so essentially what the energy diagram for this reaction looks like is we start off down here at a fairly low energy. We have the leaving group, the proton, the base, which is pulling that proton, and then the transition state, wherein I have the base connected to the proton, which is connected to the substrate. Leaving group is leaving. I have partial minus and partial minus. And then I come down to the double bond, and the base has pulled the proton. And that this chemical reaction, I hit that the wrong way. I made it look like an intermediate. It is not an intermediate. It is a transition state. And so I come right into that and come right into that. And my activation energy here for that chemical reaction, and that this is a concerted reaction mechanism, meaning that bond breaking and bond making are happening simultaneously. The rates for this chemical reaction. So as I go to look at the rate for this chemical reaction, E2 rate is equal to the concentration of the base times the concentration of our leaving group. And oh, there's a K value in there as well. And let's look back at SN2 rate. The SN2 rate was equal to K times the concentration of the nucleophile times the concentration of our leaving group. And that these two rates are very similar. So the difference being, difference is base versus nucleophile. And so the difference between an E2 and an SN2 is a base versus a nucleophile. E2 base, SN2 nucleophile. And so understanding when an E2 happens versus when an SN2 happens is understanding the difference between a base and a nucleophile. And the rate for these chemical reactions, when we look at them, the rate is that they go tertiary, much faster than secondary, much faster than primary, and that the this is for the substrate, this is our leaving group. And if we go back and we look for a second, we can also say, well, what does the transition state look like? Does the transition state look more like the reactant or more like the product? So what does the transition state look more like in this case? What is it closer in energy to? Notice that these reactions are endothermic reactions.
The product is closer to reactants, or the transition state is closer to the reactants.
Yeah. So this is an endothermic reaction. And that by Hammond postulate, that these guys are closer in energy. And so that means that the transition state, if I want to understand this chemical reaction, I'm going to have to understand the nature of the product in order to understand what is going to affect the transition state energy. So rather than looking at the substrates in this case, the product is going to be more important in these cases. And so as I'm looking at tertiary versus secondary versus primary, it's because the transition state is product-like. So the structure of the product, and there we're saying the stability of the product, governs reaction rate. We'll talk about what that actually really means too. Okay. Everybody with me so far? Let's look at looking at my notes for a second and seeing if this is really where I want to go.
Hey, Jason?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is this E2 kind of like a mixture of a SN1 and a SN2 where it has the, like with SN2, two things are going on simultaneously, and with SN1, you're relying more on the stability of the product. So you kind of take one trait from each. You know what I mean?
I think I do. Let me do something really quick. Let's see if this helps. We do this later in the next chapter, and I haven't gone into all of it, but it's nice to look at sort of a juxtaposition of each one of these reactions. When we look at an SN1 reaction, the SN1 reaction goes from a reactant to a carbocation and then to a product. And so we go through the carbocation intermediate, and there may be alkyl shifts or hydride shifts that go towards the more stable intermediate. And it actually has an intermediate. And these are exothermic types of reactions. And that the carbocation stability and the transition state for its formation and this activation energy for the rate determining step are linked through the carbocation, so that the stability of this reaction is really governed by the stability of the carbocation. When we look at an SN2 reaction, SN2 reaction is unimolecular and has no intermediate, is exothermic, and has just the single concerted step. And that the transition state in this case is governed by this sterics around the reactants and linked this way through Hammond postulate. There are no rearrangements, no shifts. So there's no intermediate. And this is concerted. In the SN1, there are both alkyl and hydride shifts. And that's due to the fact that we have an intermediate carbocation. And this is what's called a stepwise reaction, because we have a true intermediate and two different steps that are taking place there. When we look at the E1 reaction is going from a product to a carbocation. And from that carbocation, then we go to an alkene product. These are endothermic. They go through the carbocation, and the transition state and the activation energy are equivalent to the reaction above. And by Hammond postulate, the carbocation is linked to that transition state energy, and it has all the same features as the SN1 reaction. The only difference being that it is endothermic in forming the double bond products that are coming out of this. And so we're getting a double bond that is forming. We can put the R groups on there if we want, so that we're making double bonds that are higher in energy than the reactants that didn't have a double bond in them. When we go and we look at an E2 reaction, an E2 reaction is concerted in the same way that an SN2 reaction is concerted, with a single transition state. Only these tend to be higher in energy and exothermic. They have no shifts.
Exo or
endo? Oh, endo, thank you. I was moving on to my next idea there. Endothermic. Come on. And the transition state in these is linked to the developing double bond in the stability of the double bond. And what we're seeing. So this is really sort of the overview of what these reactions look like, and the transition state in the E2 is linked to the structure of the double bond, which means that because the double bonds have various stabilities of the double bonds that we can get kinetic versus thermodynamic and selectivity, of those products. The E1s, we also likewise get selectivity for endo versus, more substituted versus less substituted in terms of the double bonds. And I'm trying to link this back to Ilian's question in that when we're looking at the E2 reactions, you are sort of taking a little from the other reactions in that your transition state is linked to the product and the structure of the product. Although it's still concerted, much like an SN2 reaction is concerted. So yes, there's a little bit of both of those in there. And I think that seeing the energy diagrams all together, all in one spot, sort of ties that together. And you can see the stepwise versus the concerted sort of nature of each one of those reactions. But we're going to go into the reaction in a little bit more detail. So the E2 reactions, it's important to understand where the concerted nature of the E2 reactions comes from and why this reaction goes the way that it does. So let's look at those E2 stereoelectronic effects. Unless, I don't know if I caught the question entirely. Did that help at all in order to see all four of those reactions together?
Yeah, that was good. Thank you.
Cool. Okay. So let's do stereoelectronic effects. Here, what we're going to do is we're going to look at why E2 elimination is favored for these reactions. And let me compare this with the SN2 for a second. When we did an SN2 reaction, remember that the nucleophile needed to do a backside attack on the carbon opposite the leaving group. Do you remember why it needed to do the backside attack? Why it couldn't just hit the carbon from the side? It wasn't sterics entirely. There was an orbital argument in terms of why it had to do the backside attack. So in doing the backside attack, remember that we have the sigma bond, but then there's also this this sigma star bond that is here. So in the sigma star bond, what we typically have is, this is the antibonding orbital. We have the green and yellow phases. I usually like to do orange instead of yellow because it's just easier to see. And that the electrons were being dumped into the sigma star bond in order to break the sigma bond. And so it needed to attack into the antibonding orbital. So attack was at antibonding orbital. So that's where that argument came from. In an E2, it is much the same. In an E2, what has to happen is that when we look at the leaving group and where the proton is, we need to look at the sigma star bond. And it is exactly the same concept in that this is the sigma star, and we are going to dump electrons by the base pulling the proton. The electrons that are here that are in the sigma orbital, so this being the sigma orbital, and the sigma orbital has those two little lobes that are on it. We'll color those two little lobes in red. So this is the sigma orbital that as I pull this proton, the electrons dump into the sigma star. And that is the antibonding orbital. And in order for the electrons to dump into the antibonding orbital, into the sigma star like this, it requires that the proton and the leaving group be what's called anti-periplanar or anti-coplanar. We usually say anti-periplanar, and I don't know if I'm spelling it right. I'm just going to go with it and call it good. And what that means is that the proton, when we look at the proton and we look at the leaving group, and we can think about all the rest of what's going on in that Newman projection, that these guys must be 180 degrees apart in order for the proton to dump the electron density into the antibonding orbital. And if that doesn't happen, when they are syncoplanar, so rather than being anticoplanar, if we think about this as being syncoplanar, and I have the proton here and the leaving group, and I tried to pull the proton with the base, that the electrons are just not aligning properly. So if I think about what that alignment actually looks like, that's the leaving group here, the proton here, and I have one orbital extending out this way and my sigma orbital extending this way, and the orbitals just do not align to allow them to dump into the antibonding orbital. And you know that if they can't dump into the antibonding orbital, then what winds up happening is I get no reaction. So, no reaction, or at least very, very slow. So, there is a requirement in the E2 reaction that the proton be anti-periplanar, which determines the geometry, which means that I may not always get the geometry that I think that I'm going to get. Let's go through and look at a couple of reactions. So let's take, let me check the time. Ooh, I got 5 minutes. Looking to see if this is the one that I want to do. Yes. Okay, let's do this really quick. Let's say that what I have is a six-membered ring system, and I have a leaving group. Let's call it a bromide. And I also have on the same side of the ring system a tertiary butyl group. And I'm going to pull this with sodium ethoxide, and we'll do it in ethanol. And this is an E2 reaction. Then what winds up happening is when I look at this, it is locked by the tertiary butyl group being in an equatorial orientation. That places the leaving group, the bromide, in an axial orientation. And the proton is here. There are actually two protons that can be pulled. And so as my base comes in and pulls the proton is anti-periplanar to the leaving group, and I get a product. That has the double bond here, and that product is this guy. And I would also get the other one. I just didn't draw it, but I would get both of those, and those two are enantiomers. Those two are mirror images, and this is a fast chemical reaction that winds up happening because these guys are locked. The proton and the bromide are locked in an anti-orientation due to the tertiary butyl group. Because remember, the tertiary butyl groups can't go axial, so there's no ring flip in this. Let's compare that and look at another substrate and see what happens with a slightly different substrate. So let's take and look at a very similar reaction. And what we'll do is we'll put a bromide and a methyl group in this, and we'll look at what that looks like in a six-membered chair conformation state. So that's going to put my bromide there and my methyl group there, and this will have a ring flip. Where the bromide is now axial in this orientation and the methyl group is axial in that orientation. And I think that what you can see is that for this molecule, that this is the major conformation because it's lowest in energy. Right? But if I take this molecule and I treat it with the same sodium ethoxide, trying to do the E2 reaction, and ethanol, and I look at what happens, I have to pull an antiproton. So we have to go and we have to look at where there are antiprotons to the bromide. Well, when I look at where there are antiprotons, I've got a proton that is on this carbon, a proton which is here, and a proton which is here. Those are the three protons that are around that bromide. But when I look at them, none of them are 180 degrees to the bromide. If I take and I draw that sort of in a Newman projection, what I would see in the Newman projection is that none of those see which way I want to do it this way. The bromide is sitting in the equatorial orientation. The hydrogen is there, and the methyl, CH3, and the hydrogens that I'm looking at, one hydrogen is here, and the other two hydrogens are on this carbon. So I would have to draw another Newman in order to be able to see those other two hydrogens. But what I can see readily is that this first hydrogen is not anti to the bromide. And because the other one is equatorial, it's not going to be anti to the bromide either. That there are no antihydrogens. In the other molecule, I have a hydrogen which is there, and a hydrogen which is there, and one other hydrogen sitting in that location. And this hydrogen is the only hydrogen anti. So while this molecule is very high in energy, and that this is very little of this molecule is in this conformation. This is the only conformation that can undergo the E2 reaction. And so the base comes in, pulls the proton, dumps the electrons down, kicks out the leaving group, and I get a product that comes out of this where the double bond has formed on the opposite side of where the methyl group is. And that this is the only product that I get. Because only one antihydrogen that can be pulled. And so while I may want to instinctively draw this product and say that this one should be major because it's more substituted, you can't make this, so that this product is out. There's no anti-hydrogen that can lead to that. And so I get 0% of that product. Okay, Eric, to attack the anti-bonding orbital, does this mean that certain chiral molecules won't undergo not E3 reactions, E2 reactions? Yeah. Yes, some molecules we're going to find don't undergo E2 reactions because of their geometry, and that it's necessary to pull the proton anti to the leaving group, and that that's going to be a large degree of what we look at with E2 reactions, is making sure that we're looking at and pulling the antiproton. For instance, if I'm going to take a substrate, and I don't have notes for this, and these are hard to do at the top of my head, but if I have a substrate that has some sort of leaving group, let's give it a bromide, and then I put groups onto this, and I put the proton here, I'm trying to think about how I want to show it to you. Let's take and put, let's put two large groups here and here, and methyls just in the other locations. And I take and pull it with the base. That what I'm going to get is a double bond that has my two large groups on the same side of the double bond. And this is going to be the only product that I can make. You will not be able to make the product where you get the small groups. That was supposed to go backwards. You won't be able to make the product that is the E double bond. You will only be able to make the Z double bond because of the geometry due to the stereocenters in the chiral molecules. So what Eric is saying is absolutely correct, is that sometimes we will not get certain geometries, even though those geometries would be lower in energy for the double bond, because of the restriction that happens in the E2 reaction, in that it must dump the electron density from the proton into the antibonding orbital, which means that they must be anti towards one another. So the proton and the leaving group must be anti. So we get only one, and this product we don't get. Okay? So that that sort of takes us through the E1 and the E2 chapter in fairly short order. And now what we do is we start bringing them all together. So on Wednesday, we'll start taking all these reactions and bringing these reactions together and look at how they compete with one another. And we'll start showing a lot of data that helps to put them into perspective, that helps to make decisions about which reaction you're actually looking at. So for right now, I'm still telling you which reaction is taking place. I'm still telling you this is an SN1 or an SN2 or an E1 or an E2, and you are giving me the products. But after Wednesday or Monday of next week, as we really get into it, you will start predicting which direction the reactions are going to go, and I will just give you the reactants, and you'll have to sort through them and try to figure out which direction the reaction is going. All right, so that's where we're headed. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to stay on the line. I've gone over my time by 6 minutes. I apologize, that was a longer lecture, but I was sort of right at the end there, and I wanted to address that question from Eric and hit those things. So if there's anything else, please stay on the line. I'm happy to answer questions. And if not, y'all are free to go. Enjoy the day. I'll see those of you for the afternoon lab in the afternoon. And yeah, Eric, 5 pages of notes is standard. Sorry, buddy. I'm sure your hands are cramping up a little bit. But you can always go back and rewatch the video too and pull some of those notes from the video to make it easier. So you guys are welcome. Thanks for the love. You guys take care. And I'll stay on the line if there's any questions, and I'll address those people. Yeah, Rodrigo, I'll try and get the notes up today. Yes, I'll do my best to get them up this afternoon. I got to wait until after lecture, but maybe I can do it. I can get these lecture notes up in between the break, And then it'll just be the last lab that I'll have to get up. So I'll put some emphasis on getting those lecture notes up today. All right.